You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to What You Missed This Week. I'm Joe Weisenthal. This podcast has some of our favorite interviews from the Daily Market Close show that I co-anchor along with Romain Bostic and Caroline Hyde. What'd you miss? It's the perfect way to kick off your weekend. We've spent a lot of time talking about the various bottlenecks in the economy. Some areas like lumber seem to have cooled down a little bit, but this week we looked at one area that has shown no signs of getting better, and that's global shipping. A common industry measure of container rates between Hong Kong and Los Angeles has surged to its highest level in years, maybe ever. So we got some perspective from someone in the business and spoke with Anton Posner, CEO of the Mercury Group, and we asked Anton what his firm does and what the big challenges facing his clients are right now.
Thanks for having me on, Joe. We focus on the supply chain and logistics, global logistics for industrial commodities. So steel, metals, ores, agricultural commodities, moving them around the world for trading companies, producers, banks that are involved in commodity trade. So supply chain management focus, right?
Supply chain management focus, and they must be pulling their hair out, their clients, at the moment. There's a great story on the terminal, out of control shipping costs far up. One toy manufacturer in the UK called The Entertainer, he said, in 40 years of toy retailing, I've never known such challenging conditions from the point of view of pricing. Now, he's having to, like, stop stocking a certain kind of teddy bear because it would double in price, Anton. How much are you seeing these prices go through the roof?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, Caroline, we're seeing astronomical jumps and daily, just daily fluctuations on what's happening in the markets. If you look at the focus on the types of commodities that we're moving, which are on the metals and raw material side, industrial commodities, we're seeing, let's say, the ships that are carrying those types of commodities, handy size bulk vessels, have tripled in cost for a daily hire rate. So several months ago, a ship that would carry steel from the Far East to the United States, for example, was running at about $10,000 a day for a hire, or leasing the ship, essentially, in layman's terms. Now we're seeing over $30,000 plus per day for those ships to take a ship on time charter, on long-term lease. So, of course, that's filtering down to the per ton cost of freight that's going into the aluminum, the copper, right, the steel that is going into the consumer goods that people are buying. So we're seeing it on the shelves, essentially.
Right. So I mentioned in the intro that there are areas of supply chains, commodities, bottlenecks that have shown some signs of maybe easing a little bit. And it's not dramatic, mm-hmm. but maybe over the worst of it. It doesn't look like that. Mm-hmm. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel? Are there, or what's it going to take to start to see that number ease a little bit?
Yeah, it's a good question, Joe. You know, the big question, right, this week we saw China intervene on the copper side by releasing copper national stockpiles to try to ease pressure on commodity markets. It's going to, until there is a downward pressure on the commodity pricing in the market overall, we're not going to see much happening on, at least on the industrial, certainly on the industrial commodity supply chain side, right? Retail focuses on container, you know, container ships, of course, energy commodities focus on the tanker markets, but everything is heating, is still hot right now. We saw a little downward pressure this week with China jumping in with some of the downward pressure on agricultural commodities. The Fed's comments today on interest rates certainly helped. But when is this going to end? Good question. I'd like to know the answer to that.
Man. I thought you were going to tell us.
Yeah. If I knew the answer to that, I'd be buying some interesting futures contracts, derivatives right now.
To that end, like, how are you trying to hedge this out to a certain extent, Anton? What are you having to put in place to try and alleviate some of the pressures you're experiencing?
Sure. And Caroline, the big thing is communication with our clients, making sure that they're not stuck out there, not letting them execute trades and purchases without having the proper freight support at this point. So getting that point across to our clients is key to work in lockstep right now, to make sure that if they're going to pull the trigger on a trade, if they're going to buy aluminum, they're going to buy steel, they're going to pull the trigger on a sale of iron or coal, thermal coal or metallurgical, that we have that freight support to back up that trade before they make that particular trade. So communication, hammering home what's going on in these markets to our client base is just critical right now. So getting that communication out and making sure that they all know what's happening. Infrastructure, Joe and I talked about on the podcast last week, is another big part of it. We're seeing strains all over the place, right? So understanding what's happening in the ports, understanding the constraints that we're seeing because of the infrastructure situation, not just in North America, but throughout the globe, key also, right? What ports to avoid, what parts of the inland river system in the United States to avoid, all key.
You know, one thing that we've seen in some areas is this sort of like amplification effect, where if companies are worried about their ability to source semiconductors, then maybe they'll make even larger orders for down the road so that they feel like they can get some. There's like some uncertainty about supply. Is that create an issue with booking freight down the road? It's like, you know what, I don't know what I'm gonna need in September or October, but I'm going to try and buy some space now because I just want to get it. I want to make sure I can get on the ship, creating further logistical problems.
I think not as much of an issue, Joe. I'm not seeing that. Hmm. We're not seeing that as a major issue. The focus right now is securing space for immediate needs and short term needs. We're working on some forward longer term contract business, for example, steel coming out of Southeast Asia running into 2022. So we're trying to secure that in long-term contracts with some flexibility there. But no, we're not necessarily seeing situations where people are making, say, let's use the term ghost bookings, right? That they know or that they think is a good chance that they will not need. It's not really going to accomplish much, at least in the world of industrial commodities that we're dealing with. That's not.
And one other thing, it seems like, you know, how much are these sort of seemingly isolated incidents, like the blockage in the Suez, some of the outbreaks that we've seen of COVID in some of the Chinese ports, how much do these sort of little idiosyncratic things at a time when the chain is already so stressed really compound and reverberate for several weeks after?
Yeah, good question. The Suez situation, it was done in about a week when they cleared the ship. It certainly caused some uproar. You had ships diverting to go around the Cape, around the southern tip of Africa to avoid the canal. Turned out that was probably not the best move for those ships in terms of cost, considering how fast the canal was open. But what we're seeing in China right now with port of Yantian, just outside of Hong Kong, and several other ports with the COVID situation having massive delays, and now seeing container carriers avoid those ports, that's having some major disruptions. You have a situation that there's already a backlog, as Tracy knows, right? What we dealt with on the teddy bear example, when you already had a situation where containers were getting left behind, now you have ships just avoiding these ports altogether. So just really compounding the situation greatly. There's a few good pieces out in the media about how many ships are sitting off at anchor at some of these ports. You could just see them on marine traffic and so forth. So
Audacity Capital could be the first venture capital fund focused on crypto startups and helmed by a Black woman. The Los Angeles-based firm is going to invest in cryptocurrency-related startups led by entrepreneurs of Black and African descent, with a focus on decentralized finance. and has raised an undisclosed sum from investors, including IDEO, Colab Ventures, and Electric Capital. The fund plans to invest up to $100,000 each in as many as 3 startups a quarter, so we caught up with the woman behind Audacity Capital, its founder and CEO, Erican Obotukudo. We started by asking what opportunity she sees for her fund.
Yes. So first of all, thank you so much for having me. Fundamentally, we recognize that the next generation of the internet is being created today. And there are so many entrepreneurs from all over the world that have the greatest vantage point to create the internet that needs to exist today. So we want to back them. And we recognize that there's a whole continent in Africa and so many different parts of the world that have overlooked and underestimated founders that can literally become the next geniuses to create the better internet, to create the better financial system, and create better culture for lives of people all over the world. So we want to invest in them.
Erican, you're a woman who knows Africa. You used to be connecting there with the future of Africa. You connected investors with entrepreneurs. But you're a woman who's, I mean, you've traveled. You've been a jazz musician, I understand. You were at one point really focused on helping find a cure for AIDS in Brazil, South Africa. What drew you to crypto? What got you investing in Ethereum?
Yeah, well, fundamentally, I have been someone who's been overlooked by financial institutions my entire life. As an immigrant in the United States, my family has sent hundreds of thousands of dollars back to Africa every single year. And frankly, I can't walk into a traditional bank and be serviced for my needs to move money across continents and oceans. And so my understanding of blockchain and my understanding of crypto was that I could send money without intermediaries, including banks, to my family members in Nigeria without dealing with the incredible costs and the incredible challenges and frankly, inability to track my money effectively. And when I was living in Nigeria and literally it was at the beginning of a recession, which many countries around the world are experiencing today, I was not able to move my money in the local currency because it was deflating incredibly. And I couldn't even move it to the U.S. dollar because the national government had said there's a freeze on the dollar in the nation and the dollar had become gold in Nigeria. And when I realized that one of the largest black nations in the world, the biggest producer of oil in Africa, and one of the biggest exports of intellectual capital had a currency that they couldn't rely on, I knew that we needed an alternative system. So I dabbled in Ethereum and eventually found that blockchain has created a way for us to literally move trillions of dollars around the world without the middlemen that we have to work around today.
When you think about like the types of apps or the types of companies that can allow normal people to sort of interact with crypto, because it is extremely hard to wrap one's head around often, and the apps are confusing, and especially a lot of the DeFi apps still have a long way to go in terms of usability that sort of like the general public would be able to understand. What are the types of problems that you're looking to see solved in the companies you're trying to find?
Yeah. So fundamentally, things are challenging. You're so right about that. And guess what? It is the perfect time to now create the layer that is accessible, that is available and readily understandable by the general mass public. So we're looking to invest in companies that recognize that the infrastructure can be as complicated as it is. But at the end of the day, we need to communicate and get as close to the 8 billion people on this planet. So not only people have the opportunity to build wealth, but they can do so in a way that they understand. So we're excited to invest in companies that are considered dApps, decentralized apps, which are essentially layers on top of all of this funny sounding infrastructure that you all are hearing about today that essentially make you not even aware of what all of this technicality is and simply allow you to on-ramp nicely and smoothly into this new internet with seamless efforts to build wealth and participate in new financial systems. So we're excited about those seamless apps and solutions that make this infrastructure more accessible.
And of course, focused on those that are being built by people of color in particular, Erican. And I think what's so interesting, when we are lucky enough on this show to interview, for example, basketball stars, some celebrities who are people of color who've got into crypto, got into NFTs, for example, and are really powerfully passionate about getting people of color within it. They see an area that you don't need to be an accredited investor, that there are less blocks to actually getting in at an early stage to back these sorts of companies. How many people of color are building at the moment? How many companies are there opportunities to put these $100,000 checks to work in?
Yeah, well, fundamentally, since you all did such a great job in breaking the story, we've had incredible inbound. And right now, there's a wonderful community called Crypto for Black Economic Empowerment, which includes 150 crypto all-stars from across 20 countries. And right there alone, there's about 70 companies that are worth making a solid investment today that are seeking some of the largest amounts of capital in the space right now. So right now, we recognize that there's easily 100 companies that we can look to invest in. We want to make 1 to 3 a quarter. And frankly, with the visibility and representation matters so much, with so many more people now being able to see, wow, I can do that. I can raise $10 million and build something that has a $15 billion market cap in 4 years. I want to go and do that as well. So we also recognize that this fund is really going to signal to so many Black and brown people from all over the world that they can be the leaders in the new internet, and that we can be a check that is the first one to go into them and say, we believe in you and we validate your genius.
Well, Arakan, I'm so pleased that Olga, our colleague over in Bloomberg News, broke the story, brought you to our attention.
Thank you so
and
much.
We want to thank you so much for coming on your birthday.
Thank you.
Go out there, celebrate
woo-hoo!
It.
I think it's my 30th, y'all.
Yeah, 30, amazing.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers, they're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Now this week, Fed Chairman Jay Powell was back on Capitol Hill testifying before the House Select Committee on the coronavirus crisis. And he sounded quite dovish after striking a more hawkish tone than many expected at his recent news conference following the FOMC rate decision. The dollar fell on his comments, and we got reaction from Wynn Thin, the global head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman. We started by asking Wynn how much the current trajectory of Fed policy is consistent with the framework laid out at Jackson Hole last year.
But to me, it's entirely consistent. I know there's been some confusion amongst the media and the market, but you know, to me, it's prudent. If you're going barreling down an unknown highway at full speed and you come up on a curve, I think most drivers who are prudent would probably take the foot off the gas a little bit. And it's a simple analogy, but that's the way I view this tapering talk. We're emerging from a pandemic. You know, we think that there's no, you know, wage pressures and what have you. But as Mr. Powell said, the inflation has been much higher than expected, and it could be more persistent. So to me, I think it's prudent for the Fed officials to at least say, look, we're talking about tapering. And, you know, as Mr. Bullard confirmed earlier this week, Mr. Powell has opened those discussions. You know, people focusing on the August Jackson Hole, maybe the September FOMC, but you know, make no mistake, we are at an inflection point. You can look around the world, you can go down the checklist, but global liquidity has reached an inflection point. I think that's something that markets are not quite taking into account yet.
Okay, where then goes the great US dollar? Does it push higher? And the fact that we're expecting some sort of rate hikes sooner than expected, even if it's a couple of years off, or does it go lower because, well, yields, you know, we start to see it all being priced in and we worry more about a deficit?
So obviously, economists such as myself try and look at, you know, historic examples. Well, unfortunately, right now, we only have a sample size of one, and that's from the great financial crisis. The Fed was the first to aggressively go to zero rates, QE, and the dollar typically suffered. It's sort of in that early part. We saw that during the pandemic this past year. But it's sort of first in, first out. The Fed was also set the groundwork for a really rip-roaring recovery for the U.S. economy back in 2009, 2010. We started talking about tapering, that the U.S. economy outperformed, and the dollar started to get some traction. So again, you know, it's not much of a sample to go on, but it's the best we've got. And I sort of see this roadmap being played out. The Fed has a similar sort of roadmap for tapering and eventually hiking rates. Obviously, timing is open to question, but you know, the sort of the playbook and the roadmap are out there. The pandemic obviously is something we've never, ever had to deal with in terms of policy what have you. But Mr. Powell has done, to me, a terrific job, navigating these things. But again, I think Putin says that, you know, we shouldn't go full speed ahead when we're going into a very sort of unknown territory.
So the one sort of risk and the one thing that Powell in his press conference last week did express some possible anxiety over, not too much, is could this period of elevated inflation now, could it last longer? Could transitory inflation turn into more elevated, sustained inflation? Maybe inflation expectations become unanchored. Do you see anything out there, either in the data itself or surveys or anything else, that causes you to be concerned that this will be something other than sort of inflation related to the reopening?
Yes, now, that's a great question. You know, to me, I have more questions than answers these days. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I have to ask the right questions. And to me, the question that I think that's the million-dollar question is, what's going on in the labor market? Mm. You know, we've had this sort of anecdotal evidence that, oh, people staying home because of enhanced benefits. But the San Francisco Fed did a study last month that suggests about 1 in 28 are sort of doing this. So it's a very small amount that are sort of in this sort of thematic, we're staying home because we're being paid to stay home. It's you know, we're hearing all sorts of shortage of labor, people who are not going into low-wage industries, leaving, moving up. So to me, there is some potential wage pressure. I'm not an inflationista by any stretch, but there's so much unknown. To me, the labor market is the key. Economists all recognize that really the linchpin to higher inflation is higher wage inflation. That's the biggest question. We won't know this for several months. And that is really, to me, I think what is, you know, I think it's sort of risky for markets that we sort of have bought into this narrative that Fed, it's temporary, it's bottlenecks. But as you point out, Joe, it's, you know, what's transitory? It's 3 months, 6 months, 9 months? You can make a case for, again, as Mr. Powell did, that this could go on for longer than expected. And I would say the bond market's been incredibly patient, you know, with 10-year 150 when we've got core PCE up 3.4% possibly on Friday. So many moving parts.
Right.
But if I had to say anything, you know, the risks to me are more inflationary than deflationary at this point.
And does that go worldwide, given this is so much about people being able to come out, pent-up demand? I understand, of course, the rollout of the vaccine isn't similar everywhere. We don't see certain countries getting back online as quickly as perhaps we'd anticipated. But it does feel like inflation is something the Bank of England, for example, is having to tackle too. Where else do we see these narratives playing out?
So, you know, it's really great you mentioned that, Caroline. I look at the central banks around the world. I really see a divergence. The countries that went into this pandemic strong are the central banks that are actually talking about or thinking about or have already removed accommodation. That would be the Bank of Canada, they've already tapered. RBA is probably next. The Fed is talking about it. Norges Bank has flagged a hike, rate hike, so has the RBNZ. All those economies were doing well before the pandemic and the sort of first, you know, sort of recover. Bank of Japan, ECB, SNB, Swiss National Bank, the Swedish Riksbank, they were all battling deflation going into the pandemic. And as a result, they sort of entered this period in a very weakened state. And so those central banks are nowhere near removing accommodation. So this divergence, I think, is going to become clearer and clearer, as we sort of move through this year, the second half of this year. But, you know, it's all being driven by underlying economic fundamentals. Those that have good, strong growth, I think those currencies will outperform. Like you mentioned, Bank of England, they were the first to sort of get this vaccine rollout really going. And the numbers out of the UK are a blockbuster. So really, again, it's sort of, you know, sort of the haves and have-nots. We've got to sort of keep an eye on how these things go.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
And we're getting a bit of a buyer's strike in the housing market. Data showing that sales of new homes dropped unexpectedly in May, with high prices continuing to weigh on affordability and builders rushing to replenish inventory. This is coming as rents continue to rise as well. We got some perspective from Alan Dettmeister, economist at UBS. We started by asking Alan if we should be expecting a surge in rent inflation later this year.
To some extent, yes. We've been seeing some very strong increases in rents for new listings. So private sector data from Apartment List, Zillow, Yardi Matrix, CoreLogic Single Family Rent Index, those have moved up very strongly in recent months. They were a little weak early in the pandemic, but they have moved up very strongly in the last few months. And those take some time to get into the CPI basket, usually on average, 6 to 12 months before those get into the CPI basket, because the CPI is not looking at new rents for new leases. They're looking at the average stock of rent being paid, and they take a 6 month moving average.
Okay, Alan, I have to say, anecdotally, I feel it. I've just been looking for a new apartment, and I was thinking I would catch some sort of deal, and I had significantly missed it by several months, I understand. The whole world suddenly wants to come back to New York City, and prices are driven higher. Is this the case, though, for everywhere at the moment? We certainly feel it in certain hubs as people bring back to work and the office space. But is this a purely New York kind of dynamic, or where is it happening in the rest of the U.S.?
The monthly increases have been the strongest in New York and some of these areas where we've seen the early weakness, New York, Boston, San Francisco, and in the inner cities, not in the further out areas. The further out areas did see some big, strong increases and earlier in the pandemic, but the most recent monthly ones have been more in the inner city areas. Over the last 12 months, though, you see it more kind of in some of the areas that weren't affected earlier in the pandemic. Say, Phoenix has had some large increases over the last 12 months, but not as much in the last couple.
So then what does this mean, then, for headline inflation? It's like we can look at 4.7 or 5% and say, you know what, this is just about a few distinct categories, some supply chain hiccups and so forth, and we can expect them to resolve. But again, OER, really big component. What are you seeing in terms of the pressure that's going to put on the headline measures?
Yeah, so those will put a big upward pressure on CPI, particularly the core CPI, where owner's equivalent rent, tenant's rents are 40% of the index. A lot less on the Fed's preferred PCE inflation measure, where they get about half the weight, actually a little less than half the weight. So there's not going to be as much upward pressure on the Fed's measure. But there will be on the financial markets and tips are based off of the CPI. So that's going to lead to a little disconnect next year. We actually expect the spread between those two measures to open up to about 120 basis points by early next year, where the average is something like 30 basis points. So we expect to see actually some pretty weak numbers on the Fed's preferred core PCE inflation gauge, because you got weakness in some of the core goods prices likely to be seen when we get into the fourth quarter into next year.
And to that point, Alan, therefore, is it right for the Fed to look through what is perhaps now a sudden flight back to inner cities, and maybe that will be transitory? And I'm interested in what happens to all the suburbs that suddenly saw ramp up in rents as everyone wanted to get out of the cities. Do they then come back down? Does it offset things over time? And does all of this prove transitory, or is the only way up?
Well, the rents measure, particularly in the core, the way the BLS and the BEA, the official price indices, measure it, that tends to be very slow moving. So it's probably not going to get too strong until we're into the fourth quarter of this year or into next year. But since it's so slow moving, it's going to be really hard to tell. Is this just a transitory pickup and going back to, everybody coming back into the inner cities? Or is it really something more persistent? And so that we're going to have to follow some of these other gauges, like you showed, the Zillow and the Apartment List measure, and see if those price increases start coming back down. We haven't seen it yet. The last few months, as you showed, were just booming in those indexes.
Do you have a specific forecast for where it's going to go? We were just looking at the chart, and so still so far below. And even pre-crisis, I mean, it was well above, we were in the mid-threes for rent increases. Now we're at 2.1%. Do you see it getting back to those levels? Do you see it shooting, overshooting sort of pre-crisis paces, the pre-crisis pace of year-over-year change? Like, how far do you think it could go based on some of the other indicators you're looking at?
Yeah, so for right now, we're expecting kind of that 12-month measure to peak out well above where it was at the pre-crisis, up to about 4 to 4.25%. But I think with the numbers that we've seen on those other private sector indexes, the risks are to the upside and sooner. We've got, you know, the official indexes peaking out middle to late next year, and it could occur much quicker and much higher than we're expected if we still can see those rents for new leases moving up as strongly as they have the last couple of months.
Can you dispel the own myth I've created in my own head, or not, as the case may be, but what shows up when all these real estate brokers were offering basically just 3 months, but actually didn't change the level of rent? How does that feed into the data? Does that get picked up? Does it look as though the rents have never changed?
In theory, they should be picked up. What they try to do is, if they're giving you a month free rent, they will, the BLS will take it that you're paying 5/6 rent on the place for the first 6 months. But some of those things in their free months get pretty complicated, where you can pick different months and in the year, or take half rent for a couple months at some point. So it's not clear that the CPI really gets all of that free month, those concessions off, but they attempt to try and get them.
Let's just talk real briefly elsewhere within the basket. So again, we know the contours of current inflation. We know the Fed stance. We know the stance of the market, and the market's sort of not particularly showing any signs of, whether you look at break-evens and so forth, of being too concerned. The transitory story, well accepted. Do you see any evidence to doubt that overall?
No. As you mentioned, it's been a fairly narrow increase that we've been seeing in recent months, particularly used cars, new cars, some strength in household furnishings and supplies, furniture in particular, and things like airfares, which are still well below their pre-pandemic level, like 12.5%. And those are probably still expected to see some strength over the next few months, but that's just getting back to where they were. And for those other things, you'll see a movement away from the goods-based consumption that we've really seen since the pandemic started, down back to services-based consumption. And that'll probably decrease demand and costs for a lot of those goods. But over the next few months, I still expect to see some strong inflation numbers, probably higher than what consensus is, what the Fed's expecting. And this could lead them to be even more hawkish by the time we hit the September meeting.
And that's it for What You Missed This Week. If you like the show, make sure to subscribe and rate us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can catch our show every weekday from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Bloomberg TV and from 4 to 5 p.m. on Twitter. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.